My guest, Maurice Cotterell, was telling us before the break about his discoveries, his conclusions about gravity, magnetism, and other unsolved mysteries of modern science. One of those, and maybe the most surprising aspect of his new book, Future Science, was his conclusion about astrology. You don't hear modern scientists or engineers talking about astrology in a real sense, but Maurice Cotterell believes there is some empirical evidence. There are definitive effects that astrology, astrological factors, have on our everyday lives. We'll get into that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Engineer and scientist Maurice Cotterell's new book, Future Science, Forbidden Science of the 21st Century, looks at gravity, magnetism, and other topics in sort of a different way. Before the break, we were looking for practical ways that his conclusions about gravity might be put to the test. These guys who tried to patent a device based on the same conclusions that Maurice has reached. Maurice, might we see you as a billionaire the next time you come back? Could you, for example, build an anti-gravity flying machine?
I could, George, but I won't be a billionaire, and B, I seem to have a knack of discovering things which cannot be patented. That's the story of my life. And this one cannot be patented because it's a natural process. And the reason I say that is because we've learned how the Austrians tried to get a patent on their gravitational generating machine and failed. And what I did was, once I understood how the atoms switch each other on, because it all begins with a hydrogen atom. There are two types of atom, basically. Well, three types, but let's not get complicated. The hydrogen atom is the most simple of atom. And because it's simple, it has an electron that goes around the proton, a bit like the moon going around the Earth. Now, that gives off gravity waves, corkscrew radiation. Now, one of the considerations of the gravitational force, if it is to work, is that the source of the radiation must be equal in all different directions. And what that means, because Isaac Newton says every object attracts every other object in every direction. So therefore, gravity cannot be specifically aimed in one direction. So because all of the hydrogen atoms in the universe are pointing in a different direction, this satisfies the first requirement. Hydrogen could be the prime mover, and I'm saying it is the prime mover. The second consideration is that hydrogen must not interfere with other hydrogen atoms. Radiation from one hydrogen atom must not interfere with another one. Otherwise, you'd have chaos. You'd have one hydrogen atom causing gravity in one direction and another hydrogen atom trying to cause hydrogen attraction in another direction but failing. The third consideration is that with more complex atoms, atoms with more than two electrons, the larger atoms, the shells, the orbiting shells of the electrons, are offset by 45 or 90 degrees. And because of that, as the electrons orbit the middle of the atom, they bunch together. And as they bunch together, it makes the atom top-heavy from side to side. It tumbles like tumbleweed. So large atoms do not spin like the hydrogen atom. The hydrogen atom has one electron which goes around the equator of the middle of the atom and spins. So it gives off corkscrew-style radiation. Other atoms don't spin. So they tumble from left to right, from top to bottom, up, down. They have no coherent movement. Now, there is a fourth consideration if we've got to figure out gravity, and that is to fit in with Isaac Newton's observation that gravity from the sun and the moon pull together. In other words, when we have a full moon and the moon and the sun are in a straight line, then we get a higher tide on Earth. And when the moon and the sun are on opposite sides of the Earth, with the Earth in the middle, we get lower tides. So we've got to take that into consideration. In some way, hydrogen from the sun must switch on hydrogen from the moon, or atoms in the moon, so that they pull in the same direction. Now, once we've accommodated each of these requirements, it becomes clear that the hydrogen atom gives off corkscrew radiation. The corkscrew radiation spins larger atoms. It causes them to spin coherently. It stops them tumbling and starts them spinning like a spinning top with a whip. It starts to lash them. This corkscrew energy spins atoms in alignment. That atom, once it begins to spin, gives off its own corkscrew energy, and that triggers a chain reaction. Once I'd figured this out, it's a very simple mechanism. Once I'd figured this out, then it becomes quite clear that if you want to generate unlimited quantities of gravitational energy, all you have to do is put one of every element that we have in the universe in a container and line them up in a straight line. Now, there are the biggest atom that we could possibly have on Earth has 120 positive charges in the middle and 120 negative charges orbiting the middle. That's the biggest atom we could possibly have once we understand how atoms are made. What that means is we can have 120 different atoms in 120 different containers. So we can have, for example, in the first container, we fill with hydrogen. In the second container, we fill with helium. In the third container, we fill with lithium. In other words, we fill all of these containers with the next largest atom of the periodic table. And then we line them all up in a straight line, and hydrogen triggers the helium. The helium triggers the lithium. The lithium triggers the beryllium. The beryllium triggers the... And it goes all down the chain, and eventually, halfway down the chain, the heat will be so hot that the containers will start to melt.
Okay,
and that's
again,
all you need to do to generate unlimited quantities of energy. Now, that can't be patented. I can't patent 120 cans and put them in a straight line. I can't do that. It's a natural process. And that's why if I can't patent it, nobody can patent it. So anybody can start generating heat energy using gravitational energy by simply lining up every single element in the periodic table in a straight line. Clearly, the Earth's gravity will interfere with this string of containers, so they would have to be vertical with hydrogen at the top.
Well, again, let's get practical for a second. All right, you can't patent that, but what about a machine that relies on that? An anti-gravity machine, an anti-gravity propulsion flying machine, for lack of a better term, a UFO. Now, you mentioned that you came to Nevada, you spoke at a UFO conference, so I'd hope I'm not putting you on too much of a spot here, but a lot of the attributes described by witnesses suggest that these are incredible, intelligently controlled propulsion machines. A guy I interviewed starting back in 1989 named Bob Lazar said he worked on these black projects, that these machines were acquired from somewhere else, that they basically generated gravity. Would it be possible to generate gravity in a craft to, under your theory, and to harness that energy to create a flying machine, something that could travel in interstellar distances?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. Easy as anything. In fact, you had a guest on Coast to Coast some time ago, because somebody sent me a disc and I listened to it. And he was describing how I'm not sure if it was the Searle generator.
Searle, yeah.
It could have been. But this guy had this machine, and he said, when it starts it up, it sucks all the heat in from the room, and the room goes cold. Well, that's exactly how gravity works. Atoms suck in ambient heat from the room and convert it to gravitational energy. So as long as the temperature on Earth or in space is greater than -273.15 degrees centigrade, that's absolute zero, as long as there is some heat or light around, every object will radiate gravity waves. Now, yes, we can make flying saucers. The problem is we can't go faster than the speed of light. And this has nothing to do with Einstein's fanciful thinking, nothing whatsoever to do with that. The fact is, once we understand about hydrogen bonding, how hydrogen and oxygen bond together to form water and living tissue, we begin to realize that gravity waves hold water together. So if you go faster than gravity waves, which is the speed of light, like all radio waves, then what will happen is the hydrogen bonding will fail, because the body, if I were to travel faster than the speed of light, my body would be going faster than the gravity waves holding it together. So my body would disintegrate as soon as it got to the speed of light. So what this means is I could make a machine, a flying saucer, and yes, I could... you know, achieve speeds of just under the speed of light, but I'm not altogether sure that would get me to the nearest star, which I understand. I'm not into star physics, but 3 or 6 light years away. It might, we might be able to do it in the future if we can, you know, use cryogenics to freeze down the body and so on, because it would be 6 years there and 6 years back at the speed of light. I mean, this raises the question of, if I believe in God, which I do, and this this universe around us, why did God create the stars if we can never go there? Well, we can go there, and this is explained in the second half of the book on the science of God. And but we can't go there carrying our physical body. So we've got to wait till we're dead, then the soul is released from the body, and then the soul can visit these different star systems, because we, the soul can travel. The soul is electromagnetic energy. The soul is voltage. The soul can travel beyond the speed of light. So that I'm convinced that there is life on other planets and other stars. But that the only way to get there is not to travel in the 70 years that we get, but the only way we can do it is wait until the soul leaves the body, and then the soul will transmigrate, possibly to another star system, and reincarnate as another living being on that galaxy or wherever.
Okay, but, well, that's quite a bit to chew on. Let's before we get to that, I want to stick with something closer to home here. Back to this craft, the idea of creating craft that could do this or that, anti-gravity craft. Has someone else mastered this? Is there a black project that's figured this out? Is somebody got it in a hangar somewhere? Could it be the UFOnauts, whoever they are or wherever they're from, have figured this out themselves, and that's how they get here?
Absolutely. Not just how they get here. Another consideration, George, is that they could be here all the time. It's just that their frequency of vibration changes. In other words, we can't see them with our eyes, even though they're in front of us, because we can only see certain visible light frequencies. But if somebody, we're all vibrating at different frequencies, every single atom vibrates at a different frequency. Now, it could be that the frequency of the alien craft is such that when it's interstellar, it's at a given frequency where which accommodates travel. But once it gets into the Earth's atmosphere, it could be that the frequency of the vibration of the craft changes, and therefore we are able to see it. It's a bit like seeing ghosts. They're there all the time, but sometimes we can see them. If our vibration changes, if we are particularly upset or depressed or whatever, then we could bring our own atomic vibration to a different frequency and thereby tune in and see different things in front of our very eyes, which are there all the time, which can't normally be seen. So it's all a question of frequency rather than has somebody... Well, excuse me. I'm trying to answer the question, but there are two sides of the question. One is, have they done it? And I'm saying, yes, they have, but we can't see them. And the second side of the question is, would it help us to make a machine to go the speed of light? And I don't believe it will, because we would disintegrate.
What about time travel? What about using this incredible energy to travel through time? I mean, if you can generate gravity, you can bend space and time. Could you bend time enough to where you can travel through it, in essence?
Well, no, George, you can't have it both ways. If you have it my way, you don't start bending time. I mean, this idea of Einstein's of a big rubber sheet in the sky, it's just nonsense. There is no such thing as space-time. Relativity is nonsense. Quantum physics is nonsense. I mean, it has to be. It's not even scientific. Quantum physics is a probability-based physics. And science is not based on probability. It's based on specific measurable relationships between different physical phenomena like magnetism and electricity and so on. So it's nonsense. You can't even begin to go there. So you can't have it both ways. You can't start bending universes and have multiple universes. What I've shown in my book is you don't need any of that. All you need is a proton and an electron. You can start the whole universe. And I've even shown where the proton and electron derive from the Jenison, which is the original particle. I've called it the Jenison. It has to come from one single particle. So there are no loose ends. And every step of the book has been substantiated using scientific evidence of today. Even the gravity and anti-gravity has already been done by scientists at Yale University, but they don't know what they're playing at. They've been trying to move electrons using nano-electronic devices. They can't make tweezers small enough to move the electrons in their integrated circuits. So they've been firing helically polarized light at the particles, and they can move them to the left and move them to the right. So they've already discovered them, but they don't know what they're doing. They're moving electrons for the purpose of manufacturing integrated circuits or microchips to go into mobile telephones. They have no idea that they've discovered gravity and anti-gravity. And all they did was, once they had the gravity, they passed it through a phase change of 180 degrees to produce the anti-gravity. They passed it through a delay line, a transmission line. So every single step of what I've said in the book has already been scientifically proven.
I can guess how you're going to answer this question, but what about the concept of entanglement, what Einstein referred to it as the spooky connection between particles that are at great distances? And I know what you've already said about particles, but as I recall, and my understanding is very basic, but that, as I recall, that had been demonstrated empirically that there had been some sort of a connection. You dispute that, of course.
You mustn't take this empirical stuff seriously, George. I mean, they've empirically shown that the antineutrino exists, but I've shown it can't. Now, they've said that the antineutrino is inside every neutron. In other words, it's like a boiled egg. A boiled egg has a shell, a white, and a yolk. And they've said a neutron has half a positive, half a negative, and an antineutrino. And they said, isn't it strange that if you smash them apart in a particle generator, that the small positive one sticks around, that the small negative one sticks around, but isn't it strange that the one in the middle disappears completely? Well, you know, the conservation of energy says nothing disappears. Now, if it disappears, it meant it never existed in the first place. And that's what I mentioned earlier, that a neutron is made from half an electron and half a proton, and the antineutrino, which they say that they've seen from printouts from particle accelerators, is not a particle, it's a corridor of fusion, the same as you get in a diode. When you join a positive material to a negative material in a diode, you get a corridor of fusion, which separates the two charged areas. That's all it is. You could say a spark is a particle. A spark is not a particle. Just because you can see it and just because it might give you a shock, it doesn't mean it exists. A spark results due to the differential of voltage difference between two mediums or two metals, if you like. And it simply the voltage breaks down the intervening air and a spark flows through the atoms in the air. That's all a spark is. You can't say a spark is a particle, because it's not. So when they say we've seen these particles, this guy's wrong. It's not like that. What they're seeing is the interaction between the proton and the electron, and the electromagnetic interaction causes phenomena. It gives off light, it causes all sorts of things, and it appears that you're seeing particles, but in fact you're not. They're just manifestations between particles.
Okay, well, there are three terms that appear in your book, Future Science, that you usually don't see in a science book. One of them is astrology, another is reincarnation, and the other is God. And you suggest in the book that we are capable of seeing the face of God, that reincarnation is almost certain. As you just mentioned, matter doesn't disappear. It's basically eternal. I guess that would include us. And then your findings on astrology and how activity on the sun affects our lives in very practical and demonstrable ways was, I thought, astounding. We're going to get into that, those topics, and then at the top of the hour, we'll be opening up the phone lines so that our audience can ask you questions. And, man, we've still got a lot of ground to cover. I hope this is going okay for you, Maurice.
It's fine, George. Thank you.
But it is a lot to swallow.
It is.
All right, we're going to take a break now. We'll come back in our conversation with Maurice Cotterell, author of Future Science, Forbidden Science of the 21st Century, continues. I think this is vanilla fudge, an oldie but a goodie, vanilla fudge. You keep me hanging on, taking us into the break. Stay with us, everyone. I think our guest, Maurice Cotterell, might say that nobody dies, that we all reincarnate, that life is eternal. We come back over and over until we get it right. That's one of the astonishing conclusions he reaches in his new book, Future Science. We'll get into that, reincarnation, astrology, and the face of God when we come back. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. You know, like millions of other people, every once in a while I will take a look at my Aries forecast in the local newspaper here just for entertainment or fun purposes mostly. I never took it too seriously. Maurice Cotterell, though, has studied solar activity for a long time. The same conclusions he reached that allowed him insight into Mayan civilizations and other sun-worshipping civilizations helped him crack the Mayan calendar and gave him insight into his theories of everything, I guess, his insights into physics and other seeming mysteries, gave him some thoughts about astrology, how it does affect our lives, how it affects our lives in demonstrable and clearly provable ways. Maurice, tell me about that part of it.
Well, the story for me, George, began when I was on board ship, because when the ship sailed from north to south, everybody was happy. And when the ship sailed from east to west, they started arguing. They were very unhappy. So I began to consider the fact that something must be affecting the behavior of the people on board. And the only thing it seemed to me could be the magnetic field of the Earth, because north to south, we're going in line with the magnetic field, and east to west, we were going across the magnetic field lines. So I also, being the radio officer on board, realized that the sunspot cycle interfered with my radio signals periodically. So I started to look at how the sun might be affecting human behavior. And the story, the scientific story anyway, starts around 1927. And at that time, a German psychologist, Johannes Lange, was doing some research on one-egg twins and two-egg twins. And he determined that heredity behavior must be determined by genetic factors, or behavior must be determined genetically. The next step of the explanation was to unfold in 1958, when James Van Allen put some experiments together on the satellite Explorer 1, which discovered two zones of intense radiation around the Earth.
The Van Allen belts.
The Van Allen belts, of course.
Right.
In 1962, Mariner 2 spacecraft detected streams of particles coming from the sun, which we now refer to as the solar wind. In 1979, a British astronomer, Professor Ian Nicholson, discovered when the solar wind particles crash into the Van Allen belts, the magnetic field of the Earth in the middle of them changes. He actually says variations in the solar wind produces changes in the Earth's magnetic field that are reflected at ground level. So we can actually feel the changes at ground level. And in 1984, a team of scientists at the Naval Medical Research Institute of Bethesda, Maryland, discovered that magnetic fields from the lights in the laboratory were affecting the manufacture of DNA in test tube baby experiments. So it seemed to me we had a mechanism here, how particles were emitted from the sun, the solar wind, they crashed into the Van Allen belts. Every time they crashed into the belts, the magnetic field changed. When the magnetic field changed, it caused genetic mutations in early impregnated ovum. So all I had to do was to show that the sun gave off 12 types of radiation, which resulted in 12 types of personality. And that's what I did in 1986, when I self-published my first book called Astrogenetics. And that showed, as future science does, how the sun radiates 12 different types of particles throughout the year that cause 12 different types of genetic mutation in early impregnated ovum in the womb, and that causes 12 different types of personality. And then from that, I then had a look at how the planets might affect the radiation pattern striking the fetus, and what I discovered was that the inner planets, Mercury and Venus, modulate the beam of particles coming off the sun, whereas the outer planets, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, they have the ability to accelerate or decelerate the particles coming off the solar wind. And therefore, the speed at which the particles smash into the Van Allen belts and the resulting magnetic field changes. So we don't get 12 completely different types of personality. We get 12 types, and we have slight modifications depending on where the planets are. I also
depends on, so where a person is born, when the person is born, can affect the kind of person that they become.
Absolutely. It depends on the Earth's magnetic field and the sun's magnetic field combined. And this is why when we leave our magnetic field from where we were born, the Earth's magnetic field changes. People behave differently. It affects the hormones in the body, in the brain, and the hormones make us anxious. We call this anxiety homesickness. The same thing happens when we get on a jet aircraft and change through the magnetic fields quickly. The hormones change in the brain and we get jet lag. Biorhythms, the melatonin hormone loses synchronization. So, and this is how the pigeon finds its way home, and the salmon and creatures like that, migratory creatures, that they're sensing a difference between the sun's magnetic field from the solar wind, the northern lights, if you like, and also the permanent magnetic field of the Earth, which is generated inside our planet itself. And that's how astrology works. Very simple.
Let's talk about reincarnation for a moment, another term you don't see in a science book all that often. How does do your theories affect your views of reincarnation? How did they reinforce it?
Well, it's interesting. I met a researcher a few years ago, not that many. I mean, I'd been well on my way with my research at that time. And he'd come to the conclusion quite independently that Tutankhamun was the same person as Jesus. And it, what's interesting is the inference he drew from that. He therefore inferred, given that Jesus was Tutankhamun, that all of the dates in the Bible must be wrong by 1,500 years. So he rewrote the Bible and changed all of the dates. Now, I agree. That's one way of doing it from one inference. I had arrived at the same conclusion. Tutankhamun was the same being as Jesus.
Based
but
on
I
what?
Believe the Bible, and I believe the dates in the Bible, which means there can only be one explanation. When Tutankhamun died, he came back again 1,500 years later as Jesus. And therefore, this step of the step in existence, if you like, was born in my brain. And it became clear that there's a film going around called Zeitgeist. I'm sure many of your listeners
sure.
have seen it and heard of it. And basically it says that there are lots of characters throughout history who have come into the world and propounded or given the same creation story of a Messiah who was born on the 25th of December. He was born in a stable. When he grew up, he performed miracles. And when he died, he became the planet Venus, the brightest source of light in the heavens. And the inference they've drawn from this is that it's all a myth. It's all a lie. It's just a story that somebody's made up, that somebody keeps repeating. Well, that's one inference. What I've shown is that the guy who brought this story to Mexico was called Lord Peykal, and his bones were found in a pyramid in Mexico. Another guy that brought this story was called Tutankhamun, and his bones were found in a tomb in Egypt. Two other guys who brought the story was called Viracocha and Viracocha Pachacamac, two tall white gods who walked the lands of Peru in ancient times, and their bones have been found in the pyramids of Peru in Saipan. Now, once you realize that the people who put forward the story had bones, had arms and legs and skin, then it's not a myth. They lived. The only rational explanation is that these guys who keep coming back is the same guy who keeps coming back. It's not a story. And once you get your head around that, then you have to find a scientific mechanism which will fit in with this story. And when I went down to Mexico and started to decode the treasures of the Mayas, I then discovered pictures of God and pictures of Jesus left behind by the leader of the Maya called Lord Peykal. Now, Peykal is a derivation from the word Pascal. Pascal is derived from the Passover, the Jewish word for Passover, or the Hebrew word, which is Pasach. What this means is that Lord Peykal and Easter have something in common. It's the time when Jesus died on the cross and he was reborn. And this is what Lord Peykal was trying to tell us of the Maya. He was Jesus in a previous incarnation. Once you get your head around that, we can decode all of this, the stories in his various treasures. In the architecture of the pyramids of Mexico, we get the same story encoded as we do in the jewelry, the necklace he wore around his neck, the jade mask he wore across his face. We get the same story repeated in the paintings that they found in in temples in Mexico, and the same story found in the carvings of the Maya. It's the same story, and it tells us he was born in a stable. When he grew up, he performed miracles. When he died, he became the star Venus, purest and brightest star in the heaven. And he tells us that those with a pure heart will go to heaven, and those who don't have a pure heart will come back to earth for another try at purification. And that brings us on to all the ancient sciences of astrology. It brings us on to clearly an understanding of reincarnation. It teaches us about karma, the scientific law, the universal law of cause and effect. It explains why rich people can't go to heaven, why it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. And all of the scriptures begin to take on a different meaning. And the scriptures begin to explain why we're born, why we die, what God is, what the devil is, why we have to die, how we can get to heaven, how not to get to heaven. And all of this is in Future Science, which you've seen, George.
It is Easter, or at least it was last night. It was Easter when we started this program and discussion. So we should acknowledge at least that the Christian faith today does not really recognize reincarnation. It's not specifically, I guess, say it can't happen, but it's kind of wishy-washy about it and basically anti-reincarnation. But my understanding,
well,
and I'm not an expert on this, is that...
interject there, that's sure. Not actually true. Because what I show in the book, using Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared, is that God is electromagnetic energy.
Well, what I was going to say is that early Christian theology was that reincarnation was okay, that they were all right with it. It was changed somewhere along the way.
Yeah, there was change somewhere along the way, and that change happens. But the early Christians believed it, and the later Christians believe it, but they don't realize it. And the reason is, what I've shown in the book is that the physical world is hell. Now, it's explained in the book very simply. This is hell. We're living in hell now. Now, if you look at what modern Christians believe, they believe in the notion of body and soul. They believe that if you live a good life, then your soul goes to heaven. If you live a bad life, your soul goes to hell. What I've said is, but this is hell, which means that your body comes back to earth. So when the Christians say it goes to hell, it goes to the earth. So they do believe in reincarnation. It's just that they don't understand what they believe. It's like the scientists who don't understand what they've discovered. So using Einstein's equation, using the science of God, E equals MC squared, you know, if you look at the Bible, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, the holy book of the Hindu, if you look at the Dhammapada, the book of the Buddhist, they're all the same. The Bhagavad Gita says God is light. It doesn't make any bones about it. It says God is light. God is electromagnetic energy. It's what happens when you plug your plug into the wall, you plug your computer into the wall, it comes alive because you put God into your computer. And when God's inside things, God animates things. So you plug your computer into electromagnetic energy, it comes alive. You unplug your computer from electromagnetic energy, and it dies. The same thing happens with a human being. When the fetus is developing in the womb, it attracts a soul from God, and this is how that happens is explained in the book. The soul fires up the human electrical systems, and it animates the body. And as long as the soul is attached to the body, we are living beings. If the body gets sick, it can no longer hang on to the soul. The soul is released, and we are dead, like the unplugged computer. So this whole idea of it's not me saying that we are light. It's the scriptures. In the Bible, it says, in the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was God, and God said, let there be light. So in the Bible, light came first from God. If you look at Buddhism, it says Buddha was the illuminated one, the enlightened one. He was light. In the Bible, in the Christian faith, we believe that if somebody's voltage is very high, they radiate light from their heads. They have a halo. So if we love each other when we're on earth, when we're alive, then our soul voltage goes higher. We can radiate light from the head, and those with light coming from their head go to heaven, and they join God again. They become God again. If the soul voltage, when we die, if we hate each other while we're alive, the soul voltage gets less inside us. So when it's released from our body, it goes back and it cannot escape the Earth's gravity or electromagnetic field or the magnetic field. And so what happens is it migrates to another collection of cells which are beginning to form. For example, when you hold a flower in your hands, it looks like a flower, it smells like a flower, it feels like a flower, but it's not. It's a collection of biological cells which attracted a bubble of energy from God as it was developing. Now, when the flower dies a few days later, the soul is released, and it will recombine with the cells of a developing worm or a dog or whatever. What it means is that it's not a flower. It's God in disguise. A dog is not a dog. It's God in disguise.
And backwards.
Every living thing is God in disguise. And once you get your head around this, you can understand what's going on and why God made the universe the way it is. And that's explained in the book, why God made the universe the way it is.
You have a sort of a karmic formula for reincarnation, too, where the poor will come back rich, the rich will come back poor, black come back as white. What if you're, just hypothetical, what if you're both? You start out poor, you become rich. Which one do you come back as if you've lived as both?
Well, it's not like that. You always come back as a corollary. What you're saying is quite correct, George, but in other words, if you are a fat person in this life, you can only come back as a thin person. If you are a rich person, you can only come back as a poor person. If you are male, you can only come back as female, generally speaking. It's called the inverse process of transmigration of the soul. And this is explained in all of the treasures of all of the tomb, the sun-worshipping civilizations, whether it's Tutankhamun, whether it's Qin Shi Huangdi, the first emperor of China, the son of heaven, that's what they called him, the son of heaven, Qin Shi Huangdi, or whether it's Lord Pei Kao, or whether it's the Viracochas, that they all brought the same messages back in pictorial form. There are pictures of them in the book. And as I'm sure you appreciate, George, it's a very beautiful book.
Yeah,
it's a very
nice,
expensive book to produce, Future Science.
Yeah, the paper is beautiful.
I'd just like to mention to listeners that on Amazon.com, they've put limited availability. Now, the reason they do that is because discounts are not available on the book because it was such an expensive book to produce. It's widely available, but it's not discounted, so they have to order it. They don't stock it. That's all that means. But if you'd like copies signed by me, then you can get them off my website. So it's widely available, and there's no problem. Or you can order them from Amazon.co.uk. So, don't be afraid to discover for yourself how gravity works and how to get to heaven.
Well, it's a beautiful book, that's for sure. The artwork is beautiful. It's the paper is thick and glossy. It's very nice, that's for sure. I imagine it was expensive to produce.
And it's expensive to mail as well, George. You know, it costs $20 to mail one book from Ireland to the USA.
Wow.
Wow. Exactly.
Now, I know that you have sold 3 million books, copies of your other books.
At least, because they're available in up to 25 languages.
And are you able to support yourself just with writing?
I have been for the last 20 years.
Well, that's a great way to go. That's to be able to explore this stuff and make a living at it. The author of Future Science, Forbidden Science of the 21st Century, Maurice Cotterell, is our guest tonight. We're going to the phone lines. I'm sure this is a lot to chew on, and you have a lot of questions on your mind. Stay with us. We'll get right to them after this on Coast to Coast AM.